I've spent so much time with these other matters tonight that I'll have to make this message on Nahum rather short. Nahum is another one of these prophets that just rose up, the burden of Nineveh. He was in Judah. And, of course, the message here was just one great message. And I took with me, as I told you, this book. The Bible's never been used. And I proceeded to mark it up from Genesis all through. And the prophecy of Nahum, I have underscored it, and you just might take a look at it if you would. I've got it. But it was written about 713 years before Christ. 713 years before Christ. He was after Isaiah. Isaiah was 750 years before Christ. And he wrote it 150 years after Jonah. Now, Jonah, Micah, Nahum. And these minor prophets do have some sort of a chronological order. Most of them do. But Jonah was written around 870, 868 B.C., and it is an account of how God told this prophet to go to this great city, Nineveh. And he preached, and the city became what we would call Christian. The city repented. And they turned to God, Elohim, Elohim. This is the word. You've got Telmar Dick now, and you've got Eul, and you've got Yah. We've got evidence that there was knowledge of Elohim, and evidence that there was knowledge of Yah, the first two chapters of Genesis. And Nineveh turned to the true God as a result of the preachings of Jonah. 150 years later, it was in great apostasy. Now, what Nahum illustrates is that God judges apostasy. The remedy for it is just plain judgment. And this entire prophecy is nothing but an outpouring through the mouth of the prophet of God's determination to destroy the city. Lock, stock, and barrel. The whole works would be destroyed. And it was. 100 years after this prophecy was spoken by Nahum, the very things, the very descriptive phrases which you find in this passage came to pass. The course of the river which came alongside of the city was changed. The doors were opened, the gates were opened. The enemies went in and they completely ransacked and destroyed the city and burned the place. And I brought back with me a little package that has some of the burnings of the city of Nineveh. I was very happy that I could get it. We went into the palace of Sennacherib II. He was the great king who sought, of course, to destroy Israel, to captivate Israel. And he did. He gathered all of Israel. He got the whole land of Canaan except the city of Jerusalem. And as you know, Hezekiah prayed that God would deliver him. He had 185,000 encamped there, ready to come in and storm the city of Jerusalem. And in one night, God, by his angel, slew that 185,000. The whole army of Sennacherib was destroyed, and he went back with an empty hand back to the city of Nineveh. Now, beloved, we see these marvelous works of God in behalf of these people of Israel. I went through this Bible, and you see the works of God in Babylon, the works of God in Nineveh, the works of God, all these mighty works of God, all of which were done to protect and deliver his people. Beloved, our God is able to deliver us. He has done it in the past for all His people. And what God did in this period of His relationship to His people by showing His mighty hand, His mighty arm, His mighty works, the falling of the walls of Jericho down, all these other things that He did, are just simply tokens to you and me that that God is still alive. And that God is able to deliver His people and to care for His people. And it's a beautiful and wonderful testimony indeed. Now this prophecy against Nineveh is such a stern one, and I want to point out several things to you about it. But the first thing I want you to know, that in the midst of His wrath, He reminds us of His mercy. And in that first chapter of the verse 7 we read, "The Lord is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and He knoweth them that trust in Him." Now there's a precious text is buried in the outpouring of God's wrath and judgment against this awful, wicked city of Nineveh. "The Lord is slow to anger," verse 3, "and great in power, and will not at all acquit the wicked. The Lord hath His way." Now here we have in chapter 1 something of the understanding of how God uses the forces of nature. "The Lord hath His way in the whirlwind, and in the storm, and in the clouds, are the dust of His feet. He rebuketh the sea, and maketh it dry, and drieth up all the rivers." In other words, here in the first chapter is an indication that God uses the powers of nature, the sea and the storms. He uses these powers in His own hands, in His works of judgment against. Now, we just heard today they've had a terrible snowstorm out in Colorado. Some 18 inches fell. It's out of season. Upset everything. We just heard that they've had some terrible, terrible rains down in New Orleans. And the president's declared it an emergency area for federal funds. We just heard of a terrible hurricane or twister that fell down upon one of the cities in Florida. We've heard of these things, and we're having these acts of nature, these things taking place which are completely beyond us. God is in them. God is in them. God is putting a message across if we'll just listen to it. And that's what He wants us to heed. He wants us to listen to these messages. But now we can, in verse number 6, "Who can stand before His indignation?" There is nobody can do it. "And who can abide in the fierceness of His anger? His fury is poured out like fire, and the rocks are thrown down by Him." He just upsets them. Now notice verse 11. "There is one cometh out of thee that imagineth evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. Thus saith the Lord, though they be quiet, and likewise many, yet thus shall they be cut down when He shall pass through. Though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more." There'll be no one left to afflict. It's a total annihilation, a total judgment. Beloved, did you ever stop to think that the judgment of God upon this earth at the time of the flood was a total annihilation of all that man had except Noah and his sons, 8 persons? The judgments of God. Now here is Nahum revealing to us the thoroughness of the wrath and the judgment of God poured out against this city, which had the light at one time, which turned to Elohim under the preaching of Jonah. And now, after these years, the judgment hangs over the city, and it comes. "I will make thy grave, for thou art vile. I'll bury you." Well, that's a phrase, isn't it? Behold, upon the mountains the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace. O Judah, keep thy solemn feast, perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee, he is utterly cut off. God saying, O Judah, Judah, keep your vows, keep your solemn feast. And I would say to you, you go back to that holy land, and I see the difference every time we go back. They're keeping their solemn vows. The state of Israel has gone back to that Old Testament, and they're seeking to keep their solemn vows as a people. It's amazing to see. And as I indicated this morning, or on the radio yesterday, I have a long list of the things now that indicate what they have done. I told the story, I believe, of Tel Aviv. I told it to you yesterday. I always wondered about Tel Aviv. I've been there several times. We've landed there and come in. I'll never forget the first time we landed there. We walked in the entrance through the immigration into the baggage there, and had these great pictures on the walls. Here was the picture of the olive tree, and here was the picture of the Wailing Wall, and then here was the picture of the smokestacks of modern industry, and I looked at it. And there was your Wailing Wall as they cry out to Jehovah, as to Yahweh, they cry out to him, give us our temple back, give us our sacrifices back, and send the Messiah. There it is. I ran right into it, and I saw it, and I've often wondered about this city, Tel Aviv. In Ezekiel, it's called Tel Aviv, B-I-B. And the Hebrew letter for B is a V. That's what it is. And all that they did was to take what we have in our King James Version, Tel Aviv, and make it a V as it is, and they call it Tel Aviv. So we call it Tel Aviv. Now that passage in Ezekiel from which they took that name refers to a minority of the Jews down in Babylon, down in their captivity, who longed for the day when they would be back in their own country. And Tel Aviv was deliberately named by the Jews that set the place up to bring out constantly before everybody that they were coming back to their land. They wanted to come back to their land, and they're now back in their land. And there's so many, many of these passing references, we don't think much about them, but when you add them up and put them in line one with the other, you've got quite a testimony to the fact that the state of Israel at the present time is seeking to renew and to reintroduce these covenants and these ordinances that you have mentioned here, of course, in the prophecy of Nahum. Now, if you will turn, please, in this third chapter, you have this reference to Nineveh. And it shall come to pass that all they that look upon thee shall flee from thee and say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? Whence shall I seek comforters for thee? And the answer is that there's nobody going to be Mona. There's nobody that's going to look that. Now in this second chapter, and if you'll notice please, the second chapter and the eighth verse. But Nineveh is of old like a pool of water. Yet they shall flee away. Stand, stand, shall they cry. But none shall look back. In other words, the city is going to be so confused, and it's going to be so set for its destruction that they'll cry, stand, stand, but nobody stands. They're all running away. But here, the city of Nineveh, with all of its wickedness, with all of its vile, with all of its whoredoms, here the city of Nineveh is literally, totally destroyed. Now, in that second chapter, I gave you verse 8. Now, notice verse 7. Now, H-U-Z-Z-A-B. That also is a poetical expression for the city of Nineveh. And Huzzab shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up, and her maidens shall lead her, as with the voice of doves tabbering upon their breast. But Nineveh is of old like a pool of water. Take ye the spoil of silver, take ye the spoil of gold, for there's none end of the store, and glory out of all the pleasant furniture. It must have been a beautiful city with gold and silver and no end to the furniture. She is empty and void and waste, and the heart melteth, and the knees smite together, and much pain is in all loins, and the faces of all gather blackness. I might say to you that when you read this, it does describe the destruction of Nineveh, which did take place around 612 B.C. But there are these elements in it, as it's described, that would also describe the Battle of Armageddon. Their faces be black. You have all these references to the lions. I mentioned this morning when I talked to you about Babylon that here was a lion, the big cutout stone of the lion in Babylon, the one monument that we saw there, standing, been standing all these centuries. But when you get up to Nineveh, it's not the lion that you saw. You saw the winged ox, the face of a man, the wings of the eagle, and then the hoofs and the legs and the cloven hoof of the bull. And they worshipped him. They worshipped him. And actually, of the gates that they had in the city of Nineveh, one of them is called the Sin Gate. Calling a gate the Sin Gate. Another gate was called the Moon Gate. Another gate was called the Sun Gate. We went through these gates. And when we first arrived in our buses, we drove alongside the wall, and they are rebuilding or restructuring the actual wall as it was at that time. The course of the river, of course, has been completely changed. And the changing of the course of that river may have taken place at the time referred to here in the book of Nahum, which was fulfilled prophetically. It may have taken place at that time. We do not know. But the course was definitely changed. But we saw the wall, and they were beautiful walls. They took us to the immense gate, the main gate, which had the two bulls there with their faces and with their wings, one on either side as you entered the gate. And then inside of this immense enclosure, in over half of it, the sheep were grazing on the grass that was green. And then on the other side of it, the lower side, you had nothing but these mud hovels, these mud houses that they lived in, people lived in. We went back around on the other side. I wanted to go to one of the hillsides and go up on top of it and see if we couldn't look over the city like Jonah did when the gourd vine grew up and then the worm destroyed it in a night. But we couldn't see anything that equaled that unless we went to a far distant hill. So we decided that we would just go up on one of the mounds about the wall. And we made our way up, walked along the inner side of the wall and up to the top of the mound, and then all here. And we looked over that city of Nineveh. Do you know they claim that Jonah's buried there? I'd never heard that before. There's no evidence that we know of, but they, of course, claim that Jonah is buried there, and they don't show us his grave, of course. But that's the way these stories accumulate and gather around such events as these. But to stand there and realize that that city was in ruins as it was, utterly destroyed, as a result of a declaration that came from heaven. And the reason for it was its apostasy. They had heard the message. They had heard the true name. They had repented and become a God-fearing city under the preaching of Jonah. But it didn't last. 150 years and Nahum made his prophecy. And then 100 years after that, and Nineveh was no more. Now, when I read about the wickedness here, the adulteries and the whoredoms and the awful wickedness, God will not tolerate sin. He will not do it. We picked up the Reader's Digest when we got back for the month of May, and there's a story in there that 1 million girls run away from home every year. They make their ways to New York and to Los Angeles and Chicago, to our major cities, and they're taken in to become whores, prostitution. Nothing like that has happened in the last 20 years, last 15 years. These girls are just flying off, getting away. It explains how it's all done. And you can't build a nation with 1 million runaways, young girls in their early teens that go to these cities and they turn out to become instruments of prostitution in this country. God's not going to tolerate it. Well, the last chapter is just a few verses in this. Thou also shalt be drunken. Thou shalt be hid. Thou also shalt seek strength because of the enemy. All thy strongholds shall be like fig trees with the first ripe fig. If they be shaken, they shall even fall into the mouth of the eater. Behold, thy people in the midst of thee are women. You don't have any men left. They had an ERA, I guess. The gates of thy land shall be set wide open unto thy enemies. The fire shall devour thy bars. Draw thee waters for the siege. Fortify thy strongholds. Go into clay and tread the mortar. Make strong thy brick kiln. By the way, B-R-I-C-K-K-I-L-N. Brick kiln. Brick kiln, we call it. We saw scores of these brick-making mounds, as they have, with the smoke coming out. The same type of brick. The same type of fire. And the same situation exactly that was there in the days of Nineveh, there in the days of Daniel, there in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, there in the days of Abraham. That same identical social structure, that same identical building material, it's all there today. And I find this word, I ran into this word here, and this, make strong thy brick kiln, K-I-L-N. That's a mound where they bake the bricks, and they put them in there, make strong. Through your bricks. And that's what they're doing. That's what they did. There shall the fire devour thee. The sword shall cut thee off. It shall eat thee up like the canker worm. There it is. There's no healing of thy bruise. Thy wound is grievous. Thy shepherds slumber, O king of Assyria. Thy nobles shall dwell in the dust. Thy people is scattered upon the mountains, and no man gathereth them together. Isn't that interesting? No wonder they don't read it. No wonder they don't preach from it. No wonder they don't pay attention to the wrath of God. And it is the awful wrath of God poured out against the sin of man on this earth because he turns from God, turns to his wicked abominations, turns to his whoredoms, as it's described in this book of Nahum. Now your pastor and all of us went back and saw it. We walked about it, and it all seemed to just come alive. There was a day in 612 B.C., when what Nahum says about that city took place, it was burned. It was destroyed. Our Father and our God, we do thank Thee that when we hear a solemn message like this, that there are these precious passages running through it which do indicate that the Lord is good, that he is a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knoweth them that trust in him. We thank thee that we are among those that trust in thee. And Father, wilt thou protect us? May we be a light in a dark place. May we all love this book and study thy judgment. May we be able to warn people of the wrath to come, for thou hast delivered us from it. For Jesus' sake, amen.